Emergency edition of Microbrew. Yeah, we didn't think we'd be back talking to you quite this quickly, but here we are. It's Monday. The latest edition of our podcast just dropped, and the Brewers have major news. Josh Hader, Brewers closer Josh Hader, traded to the San Diego Padres. Those reports popping up on Monday. The Brewers making a major move, really the first major move. Maybe the second or third, I guess. No offense to the Reds and Luis Castillo with their trade with the Mariners, but I'm here again with Kurt Hoge, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Kurt, it's been crazy. Ken Rosenthal reported at The Athletic on Sunday night, kind of after we recorded, that the Brewers were at least listening again on Josh Hader. That's been kind of going off and on for a long time, but did not expect a first-place Milwaukee Brewers team to trade their top-flight closer, before the trade deadline, to another team in the National League that is ostensibly going to compete with them in the postseason. They could easily face off in the postseason. Like, this really, really caught me off guard. Just broad thoughts. Just give me your broad thoughts when you found out this was going down.
Yeah, definitely catches you off guard in a weird way, though, because, you know, you kind of figured that Josh Hader was going to get traded for basically the last 3 years. At some point, it was going to happen, right? I mean, they weren't going to extend him. He was a free agent after next year, but the timing of it, definitely a surprise.
Yeah, there's some factors there, and I think on a radio hit, I would have been surprised if the Brewers did not trade him going into the 2021 season. I think that's when it was, because I really thought that was probably when his value was highest versus the dollar amount that they were going to have to pay him in arbitration. He's due to make another 15 plus million next year in the arbitration process. He was a Super 2 player, so his arbitration clock started a little bit earlier than it may have for another player. He's obviously very good, very expensive, but still a major difference maker at the back end of the bullpen. Before we talk about the return, I guess I would be curious at the urgency to move him now at a time when they're probably 2 months away from getting another bite at the playoff apple. And yes, Josh Hader has struggled a lot lately, and we've talked about that, but to move him now at a time when they're about to go into, you know, potentially have a chance to win a World Series here. I know that's not a feeling people have, a vibe people have, but they're in that spot, and now they're moving one of their like five or six best players, probably one of their top three best players. That throws me off a little bit. What do you speculate the Brewers are thinking there in being comfortable making that decision now?
Yeah, like I said, the timing's super interesting. You figure that probably this is their best chance at getting a good, the best return for him. I mean, the return probably has decreased a little, you know, as you go on compared to the offseason before this and the offseason before that. I guess the pieces kind of added up in a way that, you know, they could trade him. They get Taylor Rogers, a capable fill-in in the back end of the bullpen, another lefty, interestingly enough. And then you get some, you know, some other long-term organizational depth pieces. I don't mean to undersell the players they got, but you know, getting four players in return does adds your organizational depth, and we can talk more about those guys later. I just keep coming back to the fact that it is surprising, though, that they would kind of go into a sort of a counterintuitive in a way strategy of, you know, kind of retooling on the fly in the middle of a playoff race at the trade deadline. It just shows you that the Brewers are never ruling anything out whatsoever, and this was what they felt like was their best chance. And, you know, maybe within their organization they see Taylor Rogers as almost as good as Josh Hader. Obviously he's not Josh Hader, but kind of getting that piece I think is a big part of it. Yeah, I'll say it again. It's surprising, even though, you know, we kind of all saw it coming at some point.
Okay, so here is the return. Taylor Rogers, like you said, very similar season to Josh Hader in that he was excellent early. He signed with the Padres on a one-year deal. He's a free agent. After the year, he'd been with the Twins. He was an all-star last year. Awesome season. And then he hit a roadblock. July was not a good month for him. It was very bad. Just like Josh Hader. Josh Hader had not given up a run through the first 2 months of the season. And then things started to go a little bit sideways, and the last month has been a struggle. I don't, like you said, probably not like a one-for-one switch, but if you're talking about a small sample, it's possible that Taylor Rogers can be close to what Josh Hader is, so that's something. And then you get a couple prospects, Robert Gosser a pitching prospect who's kind of an older guy for his age level at advanced class A, but is a top 10 prospect in their organization. And then a fast rising guy named Asturi Ruiz, outfielder who has got some blinding speed, has really improved his offensive numbers, but in some hitters parks. And at the big league level, we haven't maybe seen a whole lot out of him yet. So he's a guy, he's 23 years old. He's a guy who could fill in probably this year and down the line. And then you get Denelson Lamet, which is a guy who in 2019 was an outstanding starter, one of the best starters in the National League, fell way off a cliff, got into injuries and such. I've talked to Keith Law a few weeks ago, and you know, he really points out that anytime the Brewers add a pitcher, you pay attention because the Brewers have this track record of turning pitchers into gold. Maybe that's the case for both Lamet and Taylor Rogers. Maybe they see something that they could fix. Taylor Rogers presumably is more of a short-term thing until get them through this season. And I do believe, and I believe this genuinely, not trying to find a positive spin, four players for any reliever, four players who are relatively close to the big leagues or at the big league level, that's really good. Josh Hader is a one-of-a-kind reliever, but that's still really good for any reliever, especially a reliever who's been struggling lately. So I do think that is, I'm not as concerned about the what they got out of it as much as the timing seems to be something that's a huge, huge risk. Any of these guys jump out more than others in this deal?
Well, the guy that jumps out the most, I think, has to be Asturi Ruiz, because like you said, I mean, getting four players, and by all accounts, you know, you got two pitchers who are big league ready and like have, I mean, Lamet has really interesting underlying stuff, took fourth in the 2020 Cy Young voting. And then Taylor Rogers, obviously a well-established reliever, but you know, you've only got, I think, a year and a half of control combined, or a year and a half of Lamet and then a half year of Rogers. So if you're going to trade Josh Hader, you need to get a guy back in, you know, multiple years of an impact guy. And I do think they did well to sort of buoy the effect of losing Hader in the short term. You need to get a piece that is going to be an impact player, and you can say with a high percentage of likelihood that is going to be an impact player in the long term. And so a lot of that does fall on Ruiz. I know that that Gosser has kind of jumped up the prospect ranks a little bit, and kind of he's probably, you know, one of the top 10 players in the Brewers system now or so, and a system that's sort of void of pitching now after all those years of having nothing but pitching and no hitting. But Ruiz is the guy that's close to the big leagues. You know, the Brewers always need young, cheap, controllable bats, you know, that have the 5-6 years of team control that can impact the squad, because that's just how they're current roster is built. They need those guys to produce. They need to have impact players on the offense because they're so good at developing pitching that I in my mind, a lot of it does fall on Ruiz. I'm not sure he's the slam bang player, you know, slam bang, slam dunk player that you would want as sort of a headliner in a deal, even though this deal does, feels like it's sort of one without, you know, a main headliner. So, yeah, it's that sort of, I guess, my reaction to the return. It's I think they did well, but it's also a mixed bag of, you know, you kind of want to walk away from it feeling like you got a certified capital D dude.
Yeah, and I mean, we've kind of talked about it, danced around it maybe a little bit, the things that make Hader a guy that was likely to be dealt at some point in the future, and now you're seeing a lot of national writers pointing out that it was probably going to happen this offseason if it didn't happen now. Part of it is the money. The this organization is a not a bottom third payroll team, but it's very close to one, so those are dollar signs that make things a challenge. Fans don't want to hear that, but that seems to be still part of the equation for the Brewers. It seems like his preference and his insistence has been to work in a very defined role that is single inning, ninth inning save situation or tied. You know, this organization, when Hader first came up and pitched even into 2018, he was used in a multi-inning role. He was kind of, there wasn't necessarily something ascribed specifically for him. It wasn't a capital C closer per se. And Craig Counsell had kind of gotten a lot of kudos for how he used his bullpen. That all went away over the past couple of years. And the thing you kind of point to is, well, that just must be how Hader wants to operate. He has a little bit of a frosty relationship with this organization dating back to, you know, well, certainly into 2019 when they just renewed his contract. They couldn't work out, you know, anything more substantive. There haven't been any rumors of extension or anything. It didn't seem like it wasn't. Frosty might be too strong, but it didn't seem like Josh Hader was necessarily, certainly wasn't planning to stay here after free agency hit. I don't know how much that informed that or his, I don't know, unwillingness or just hesitance to work multi-inning situations, if that plays into this at all. Were there other red, I mean, are there red flags? Is that what these are? Or are these just sort of circumstantial things that you can't really say played into this one way or the other?
Not red flags, but I would say yellow lights, which, you know, as a driver, you know, sometimes yellow lights make you give you a sense of urgency and make you speed some things up. Frosty's, I would not say things were frosty between, you know, between the two sides. I think the Brewers, more than anyone, you know, within the organization, appreciated how good Josh Hader was. I mean, you talk to some of their brass, and you know, they sing his praises as one of the best starts to a reliever's career in history. But at the same time, between this sort of Hader wanting to pitch in one inning stints and not be used as he was, in a way to help, you know, gain saves, which helps you in arbitration, helps you make more money, whereas kind of being that sixth, seventh, eighth inning firearm multi-inning guy is not going to make you as much money, and also is probably more wear and tear on your arm, to be fair. And Hader did excel in that single inning role, but just some differences between the organization and Hader in terms of the usage there, and Hader ultimately, you know, kind of winning out in that. And then it was just obvious that they were not going to extend him at any point. I don't think the Brewers were ever going to pay going market rate for arguably the best reliever in baseball, the most volatile position in baseball. You know, historically, those kinds of deals just don't work out very well. So a variety of things always kind of pointed toward this happening. I don't think, like I said, I don't think things were frosty by any means, but it just made sense. What's going to be interesting to see, though, is kind of the reaction to it in Pittsburgh tomorrow.
Yeah, and I mean, fan reaction is not happy. I mean, everybody wants to see the Brewers add pieces. They don't want to see them subtract, again, one of their difference makers. And that's kind of what this looks like. Now, one of the pushbacks is going to be that the Brewers are being cheap here, that they just simply are looking at that price tag and arbitration down the line and figure they're going to trade him this offseason or really soon. So better to do it now when you could get probably the most in return for him. So I don't know if that's a fair criticism or not. The Brewers, you know, obviously they gave a big contract to Christian Yelich. They don't often commit massive contracts. They can't really afford to do it. They're not the Dodgers or the Cubs or the Angels. And that's unfortunate, but that is the way it is. And at the same time, you know, for as much as they have sung his praises, it seems like he's the type of guy that they would certainly want back there, certainly want closing games. And if he's right, which again is still a question mark at this point, you know, if he's right, it seems crazy that they would deal him, in my mind, in the middle of a pennant race. But I don't know how you feel about that. If you think money is the draw, maybe I'm naive, but I don't feel like money is ever going to be the only thing they're thinking about when they're making deals, that they're past that point and that they are considering that maybe Josh Hader simply isn't going to be as great as he's been going forward, or certainly isn't going to be good enough to merit $15 million and beyond, like that there will be a depreciation. But maybe I'm just being naive. What do you think about that, the dollar being the driving force here?
Yeah, I do think it would be foolish to, and a bit naive to say that dollar is not at all a force. I don't think it's the driving force quite either. Another thing that'll be interesting to see, you know, they're basically going to, you know, adding Lamet, which will be about a $5 million salary, subtracting Hader anywhere between, you know, 16, 15, and 20 million. So coming out with, what, $10, $15 million of savings next year, what they use that to. But no, at the end of the day, I think it's just maximizing value in general, and part of value is the dollar sign, but that's kind of how the Brewers have operated as an organization, and this must have been there in their mind that maximizing the value for Josh Hader, whether you know his performance was, you know, they felt it was kind of going to start depreciating a little bit, still be, you know, probably an elite level, but maybe not quite the absolutely absurd elite level that we've seen. Getting multiple players for a year and a half of a reliever, you know, it does kind of fit their model. Almost like it's almost like a Tampa Bay Rays trade in a way, where you know you trade a guy before it's too late, while someone's still willing to pay for him. money is always involved. To kind of, get back to the heart of the question, money is always involved to a degree in these things. And the Brewers would be best off now spending those savings elsewhere, whether that's acquiring, some salary at the deadline now or investing it in, you're not going to get a ton of savings there into one of these pitchers, starting pitchers extensions. But, it would be good to see it reallocated in a way because they are saving a fair chunk of change.
Yeah, I think that's also maybe naive thinking. It'll just be pumped back into the product on the field, but that, maybe you're seeing some rumors, not rumors necessarily, but rumblings from Bob Nightingale and others that the Brewers are listening on a lot of people, including Omar Narvaez and Colton Wong. We've talked about those guys, actually mentioned them on the podcast this week as guys who maybe haven't performed as much as the Brewers would like. I don't think this doesn't sound like this is the last move that the Brewers are going to make. This could, but this tells me, Kurt, this could be a really refashioned team. I kind of was setting myself up to just expect not a whole lot for the Milwaukee Brewers because, that's just typically how it goes. It always ends up being a little bit more underwhelming. But to move one of your top pieces for a bunch of guys, which again, I think is not a bad return. I just like that tells me they're kind of willing to rewrite everything. I guess. I don't know. Is that wrong? Like, can they just go business as usual here, or do you think there's just a lot more coming here?
Well, business as usual is definitely not going to be. I mean, there's an elephant in the room that has to be addressed. I mean, it is a business, and this is how the business as usual operates. But you can't say that within that clubhouse, this is going to be business as usual. You've got 20, what, 25 other guys in there that are used to having Josh Hader around, the best closer in baseball for the last 3, 4 years. And so that's something that I think is maybe in, an underrated aspect of this is, okay, how do they, it's professionals whose, jobs are to pick up the pieces and go play baseball, and kind of understand the context of it all. But it's still going to be like from a human aspect, that's going to be difficult. And you kind of wonder what the unspoken sentiments are. And we'll get to more of the bottom of that probably tomorrow in Pittsburgh, especially. But as far as business as usual at the trade deadline, dude, there is all bets are off. I was hearing from someone outside the Brewers that like they're just, I mean, out of the box is the way to describe it. And the Brewers are always out of the box to a degree, but that's kind of how they're approaching this more than ever. These expiring contracts are all they're all up for consideration. The Brewers are trying to extend their window, I guess, by adding more pieces around the roster, more controllable players, pushing some of that organizational depth greater. We'll see what happens and how much they end up buying in terms of the traditional selling prospects to get current big league talent. It's a wild, wild west with how the Brewers operate on these things.
As Hader has struggled, I think it's been notable. Devin Williams' success has they've actually he's actually wound up facing some of the tougher parts of the lineup than Hader has and been delivering in a big way. I don't know if I see this team necessarily going to a just simply making Devin Williams the closer, the ninth inning guy from here on out with Boxberger, Taylor Rogers, maybe Trevor Gott sliding in there as well. What do you think? Is it just straight up Devin Williams takes his place? Is that it?
Well, Devin Williams is, yeah. I mean, Devin Williams, I think, is going to take his place as the ninth inning guy. I do wonder if the bullpen roles become a little more flexible as well. The Brewers have, notoriously gone from being one of the most forward-thinking pitch guys whenever, even though they throughout it all, they have sort of always had that ninth inning closer, but they've been, early on in this contention cycle, they were throwing guys in any spot. And I don't think they'll move Williams around. I mean, you look at his, ever since he's come to prominence, pretty much been locked into that eighth inning role. So just a bump up to the ninth inning, won't be too much there. But they add Rogers. He's sort of able to fill in eighth inning, kind of be a multi-inning. He's been a multi-inning guy in the past, kind of filled a variety of roles. Lamet's an interesting name. I mean, the numbers have not been there at all, but the underlying stuff is very interesting, and he could be a successful high leverage guy. And they will probably add more relievers. That's the sense that I'm getting. They're not done yet.
Yeah, Lamet, they think they can fix Lamet and turn him back into what he was in 2019. No doubt in my mind, and maybe they can. And we'll find out. A lot of ripples still to come here. We're gonna find out where these guys are gonna get slotted in the organization. Is Ruiz gonna be AAA or big league? Like, there's so much still to discuss, which we'll find out as the week goes on. Kurt, I know you got way more to talk about or way more to write about here, so I will let you go. But thanks for checking in with us, man.
All right, JR. Good talking to you. We'll see what else is down the road.
Yeah, we sure will. All right, catch you soon.
Catch a bite.
All right. So if you listen to yesterday's podcast, you heard me tease that I had an interview lined up with Doug Melvin to look back on the 2015 deal to get Josh Hader, among others. But Hader was winds up being the spotlighted member of the trade class that the Brewers pulled in there. And now that there's new Hader news, it feels a little crazy to just hold on to that for a while. So you know what? We're gonna put it here. It's probably not it's not the timeliest anymore. It's not maybe doesn't even make all that much sense given that there's plenty more urgency and more to unpack with the Hader deal. But you know what? We'll just you've seen behind the curtain here. You're just gonna have to bear with me. I waited too long to play this interview. I don't think anybody at this time on Sunday night even thought that Josh Hader was going to be traded, but here we are. So again, to prep this, Doug Melvin, former Brewers general manager, he was replaced by David Stearns in 2015. He led the Brewers for a long time, pulled them from being a team that was perennially not contending to getting them to the playoffs in 2008, 2011, and pulled off this really fascinating deal in 2015 that a lot of people remember. The Brewers were able to acquire Brett Phillips, Domingo Santana, Josh Hader, and Adrian Hauser from the Houston Astros in exchange for Carlos Gomez and Mike Fiers. There's a lot that goes into it, including the fact that the Brewers thought they had a deal with the New York Mets for Wilmer Flores and Zach Wheeler, straight up for Carlos Gomez. Wheeler was hurt at the time, but as many people know, has turned into one of the better pitchers in the National League with the Philadelphia Phillies. But Wilmer Flores, of course, is the guy who was in the middle of the game. Word got to him that he'd been traded. He begins getting very emotional. He's crying on TV during the game. Fans notice. The TV cameras notice. Everyone thinks that he's been traded, including Wilmer Flores. And the Mets eventually say, forget it. We're not going to do the deal. It's off. And, of course, the speculation being that the ownership, the group with the Mets, decided that they couldn't bear to part with Wilmer Flores after that outpouring of emotion, or they just had second thoughts. Carlos Gomez, the Mets claimed that Gomez didn't show well. His medical results didn't show well, and they nixed the trade. The Brewers turned around and very quickly were able to get a deal done with Houston. Of course, at the time, David Stearns, now the general manager of the Brewers, he was with Houston in a front office capacity. So he's on the other side of this trade. One of the last moves Doug Melvin made, and it was a doozy. And of course, Mike Fiers going to Houston. He throws a no-hitter, winds up being a whistleblower on the cheating scandal. So there's all kinds of ripples to this. But I wanted to go back in time and relive it a little bit. Again, the timeliness, questionable here. But enjoy it if you are looking for a little bit more, thinking about Josh Hader and his legacy in Milwaukee, now that we can kind of look at it in total. He is no longer a member of the Milwaukee Brewers, and we'll have a lot more to say about that. But here is my chat with Doug Melvin from a couple weeks ago. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll chat with you again soon. My guest is Doug Melvin, former general manager of the Milwaukee Brewers. Many Brewers fans still familiar with the many moves he made during his long tenure with the Milwaukee Brewers. Still with the Brewers, I believe, right, Doug? I guess I don't know officially. You're still a consultant, correct?
An advisor's role, but David and his staff are doing well. I go to spring training for a couple of weeks. And
nice.
I'll get to see a few games during the year, but I watch them on TV. I follow them. Call Craig Council once in a while, but otherwise things are going well for the Brewers.
Yeah, and one of the reasons things are going well is because they have a couple guys, Adrian Hauser in the rotation, but more importantly in my mind here, Josh Hader, the all-star closer, who's having another terrific year. And so I wanted to revisit this moment in 2015, July 29th and 30th specifically, the moment that the Brewers traded for Josh Hader. And I know we've actually personally talked about this before, and it's been written about before, so this isn't necessarily novel territory, but as many people remember, the Brewers had a trade. You guys had a trade set with the Mets for Wilmer Flores, and it fell through. Wilmer Flores was upset on the field. Many people remember the scene with him crying on the field after learning that he'd been traded to Milwaukee. The deal then gets nixed kind of mysteriously, and you turn around and are able to trade Carlos Gomez, and Mike Fiers to the Houston Astros for four players, including Hader and Hauser. So people kind of, I think, know the bones of the story. But I guess I'll just have you go back in time a little bit to those initial conversations. Carlos Gomez wasn't going to be a free agent, but that 2015 Brewers team seemed like, you know, it was pretty clear they weren't going to go to the playoffs. So it seemed like it was the right time for the Brewers to trade a guy like Carlos Gomez. The Mets were obviously interested. So do you remember what those initial conversations were like, if that came together quickly or if that was sort of a long process working with the New York Mets?
Yeah, I think it came along pretty quickly. I think that, you know, we were still determining whether we wanted to trade Carlos or not. And you know, we put out feelers at that time, and the Mets had some interest, and Houston had a little interest, but that came even a little bit later. So like the, not unlike the Sabathia trade where we went out and got made that trade early, this trade happened a little bit later. And that's what I always did not want to make the trades wait till the deadline, because they always feel sometimes when you wait right to the deadline, you're making a deal you didn't want to make. But this one turned out well for us. But the conversations with the Mets with Wilmer Flores and Zach Wheeler, and we knew that Zach Wheeler may not pitch the next year until midseason, and that, but we thought we could be getting a quality arm for Carlos at that time. And you know, they failed him on the medical. We thought the deal was done. The trainers had told us that the deal was done. When Sandy Alderson called me, he said that they just felt uncomfortable doing it. So at that particular time, that's what I had my scouts all in town at that time. And I said, okay, guys, it's late tonight. Let's go home, come back, and let's start early. And let's figure out a trade with the Astros, because they have interest. And I would prefer to move Carlos before word got out that maybe people thought there was a medical issue. People do live in fear of those, and we did not feel there was a medical issue with Carlos. He was playing every day, our staff did a great job. The scouts, our front office did a great job in getting together, pulling names together. It was very helpful having them in town instead of having to call them and call this scout, call that scout, get a you know, phone conversation. Well, it was very helpful to have them right there with us. So we were able to call Jeff Luhnow at the time, and we went back and forth on a number of players and really it was Carlos, and we're talking about Domingo Santana, Josh Hader. Those names were in, and we were trying to get Brett Phillips, and they did not want to give up Brett Phillips at the time. And then once we included Michael Fiers, they came back, and we were able to get Brett Phillips in, and then Adrian Hauser was the last player that we went back and forth on about five different players and came to the agreement on Adrian, who has turned out to be a very, very good pitcher for the Brewers. And he and Hader have, you know, been obviously still helping the Brewers along the way. And that's what's, it's amazing about this. This was 2015. We're talking, you know, 7 years ago, and we're still feeding off of that trade.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think most people know Brett Phillips is part of the trade package that brings Mike Moustakas to Milwaukee in 2018. And Domingo Santana had a very effective 2017, 2018. He has a big hit for the Brewers in game 163. So, you know, even those guys had a really big impact. So when the deal was nixed, and I neglected mentioning Zach Wheeler, which is crazy because, of course, he was a big part of this deal as well and goes on to be a Cy Young contender in his own right. Did need Tommy John surgery in 2015, but he's a big part of this as well. The deal gets nixed. You said all the scouts were in town. My understanding, recollection, is that you guys are all out to eat at Carnivore, the very, I would say, kind of famous restaurant in Milwaukee, and had the game on TV and even saw some of this unfolding in real time. Is that how you remember it as well?
Yeah, we were downstairs at Carnivore, and we thought the deal was going to happen, and we were putting an end to the night at that time. And then I got the phone call from Sandy Alderson, and he said the deal's not going to happen. And Roger Kaplinger, our head trainer, had just told Gord Ash, he heard back from their trainers that the deal was going to happen.
Oh, weird.
And so Gord thought I was just joking when I said, deal's not done. And so Gord said, that's just Doug being Doug, you know, trying to be funny, whatever. But it wasn't, and the deal just didn't happen. And we were a little bit surprised. But I understand it from the Mets standpoint. If there's some reason you don't feel comfortable about making the deal, you don't make the deal. I've been on the other ends of those kind of things, too. So the communication doesn't end until you hear back from, you know, Sandy Alderson, the other general manager. And that's when the deal's either finalized or not finalized. So whatever reason the Mets did not want to do the deal, I don't know that for sure, other than they just felt uncomfortable at that particular time in completing the deal.
Right. And Gomez did have some hip issues earlier that year, but he had never been on the injured list for it. And it seemed like it was it certainly wasn't an issue in Brewers circles at the time or among Brewers fans or anything. Of course, the fan speculation is that Wilmer Flores having that moment on the field where he did have tears in his eyes contributed to the Mets' decision, to maybe owner Fred Wilpon's decision or whomever's decision to nix the deal. How do you feel about that? I mean, do you think in the years since your mind has changed about that? I know you said it's not clear. You know, we'll never really know what was going on in their heads. But do you think does your opinion now, has that shifted from the moment when you're seeing all of this unfold?
Yeah, you know, a little bit. I thought maybe that's, showed that he was a popular player. He didn't want to leave. But we were also taking on a player that had injury in Zach Wheeler.
Yeah.
Who there was a lot of uncertainty with his status and that. So, again, Jeff Wilpon was the owner at the time.
Sorry.
So, yeah. And he was the owner at the time. And, owners do get these kind of big deals. They're run by them before they're done. And I've been as general manager for 20 years, and I've had probably 3-4 deals over my career that were nixed by ownership. And that's fine. Owners own their club. They get to have a say in those kind of things. But I had a couple in Texas that were nixed. At that time, I thought I was going to Jared Washburn in a deal from the Angels, and it didn't happen. They didn't want to put him in the deal at the end where the general manager was okay with it. So those kind of things do happen in the game. So I understand, probably my experience is that I understood it probably more than what some of the other people did when you're making these kind of trades.
Sure. Famously, Carlos Gomez gets his picture taken with I believe Martin Maldonado posted this. Coincidentally, Martin Maldonado also ends up on the Astros down the road, but they're in the plane ride back. The Brewers are coming home from a road trip. And it's sort of a farewell picture that gets posted after this Mets trade leaks out. And then of course, that doesn't end up being the case. Do you remember having to call back up to the plane and say, by the way, this isn't happening yet, we're working on it? I mean, what, that had to be just tough. What were those conversations like?
Well, yeah, I think I can't remember whether I called or Gord Ash called with Craig at the time, but he got on the plane leaving that time thinking he was a New York Met.
Right.
And when he landed, he was not a New York, he was still a Brewer. And so we had to have those conversations with Carlos. And I don't remember if I talked to Carlos directly. I think we told Craig to just talk to Carlos and that we'd see him at the park the next day. So, those are all tough conversations. Today it's different. Players want to know if they're involved in trade talks. Sometimes you can't do it. So sometimes you read the rumors. The rumors don't, whatever you've read in a rumor isn't necessarily happening at all. And, that it gets out there. But this was for real, that Carlos was involved in a trade. It was for real that he was now remaining a Brewer till the next day. And, I just wanted to be able to try to move him before the game that night, because I just felt that after that, it would just been a little more difficult to try to trade at the time. But our people were just felt that we could get a pretty good package back from the Astros of young players that, and we were having a disappointing season. We weren't making the playoffs. And if we could get 3 to 4 players back that we felt were close to being major league ready, we felt we needed to make that kind of deal. And that's why we went through with it. We had a number of people see Josh Hader. Our question on Josh Hader was, why is this guy that's had such a great arm been traded twice in like a 4-year period? And why would Houston be willing to give up this individual? But we had people that talked about Josh Hader and saying that he was going to be a reliever. Okay. He wasn't going to be a star. He was going to be a reliever. And so I asked the question, is he going to be just a reliever or is he going to be a great reliever? And we had people in the room that said they thought he would be a great reliever. They thought he had the ability to do that. And we were a little patient with him, but he came on pretty quick when we got him and we put him out there. But that was the difference when the scouts were in the room and you could hear the emotion from the scouts in the room emphatically that this guy was going to be better than just a reliever, because how many relievers are there today in the game? You know, the way the game is, there's so many, there's less starting pitchers than there are relievers. And that was the difference, is me being able to hear the enthusiasm and the expressions and the face to face with the scouts, and hearing them, that had a number of people that had seen Hader. I think that's what, put us over the top of, let's get this deal done.
Yeah. And I think I read that your son, Corey, was part of the scouting team on Hader. Is that right? Did I read that correctly?
Yeah. Zach Manassian was head of our scouting department at that time. And Corey had seen him. I think Ryan Thompson had seen him. I believe Zach had seen him, but we had enough people that had seen the Astros, and we had a really good feel for them. Ryan Thompson had covered the Astros at the time, and they had some good players. So we were able, when we were exchanging the names with Jeff Luhnow at the end, we were able to respond pretty quickly. I didn't have to make a lot of calls, because Jake Maris, I think the center fielder, was talked about, but they didn't want to give him up. At the time, they didn't want to give up Brett Phillips, and there were other players in there. There was a big left-handed hitting first baseman, I forget, that we talked about, and they didn't want to get him up. He's not playing right now, I don't think. But so it's fun to go through those trades and revisit them. But in the end, you know, Corey, Ryan, Zach, and a number of them, I think Mark Thompson saw him, a number of them had seen him. So when we were able to exchange names, like I said, we didn't have to make a phone call. We didn't have to send a text. We didn't have to even – they were right there. So that's – I go back and I still say how that's very helpful to have the guys in the room when you're serious about making trade discussions.
Yeah, you said power hitting first baseman. My first thought was John Singleton. I wasn't sure on the timeline, but he, of course, at AAA now with the Brewers, he's kind of trying to make a comeback. I don't think that's the guy we're talking about. But Phillips was the minor league player of the year for the Astros the year before. I remember thinking that guy was kind of the jewel of the trade. At least that's the initial impression, is that he was kind of the guy, and obviously he's still in the big leagues. Not necessarily an impact bat, but fun personality. He had a huge hit in the World Series, of course. I get the feeling that this deal, you're talking about sort of the relationship you had with Houston and the awareness of it, that it wasn't like you could have pulled this off with, you know, 15 other teams to turn around that quickly and make a trade. That it was really just Houston, maybe one or two other teams that you would have been equipped to work with. Is that right? That this was, you know, that your options are maybe a little more narrow than we would have realized in the aftermath of something like this.
Yeah, it was, Jeff Luhnow was very upfront that he was interested. So
cool.
I just stayed with that. I didn't want to call other clubs and engage with them when I felt I had a team already that we could make a deal with. Sometimes you can call too many clubs, and then all of a sudden it gets the water gets muddy. And then you're not sure and certain that you're getting the right response over the phone. Well, we might have interest in them. Let me get back to you. And you're waiting for a few hours for them to get back. Or some other team says, yeah, we'll give you a couple of A-ball guys. And I just said, I'm not going to go down that road. I'm not going to call any other clubs. The players we were talking about, Santana and Hader, were both initially in the deal. And I knew that those two guys were available. There was no pullback on them by the Astros. The pullback was on Brett Phillips all the time. And then Hauser was the fourth guy that we agreed upon and exchanged a number of names to finally get Adrian Hauser as part of the deal. But Phillips was the one that kept getting pulled back. And when we did acquire Phillips, I had Oakland called me immediately, you know, as soon as we acquired him, and asked if we would be interested in moving him. He was very popular. I think he fit that analytic model at the time. He had some power. He had walks. He had high strikeout total walks, but he was a good defender, good personality, good run and that. But he fit the analytic model for a lot of teams, and I think that's where the level of interest was after we immediately acquired him.
You've got me thinking about all the other deals in Major League history that didn't happen because of a player you wouldn't even realize. Like, team agrees to trade this transcendent player, but the deal gets hung up because of somebody else. Did you work at all with David Stearns during this process or at all? Because he's obviously in the Astros front office when this deal goes down, and shortly thereafter, he's appointed your successor. Did you know him or have any relationship with him?
No, I did not. I didn't know David at the time. And, you know, I think he had the, he was running the farm system, was assistant GM, I believe, at the time, and that. But it was strictly the calls were with Jeff Lunell.
Sure. Did you have a sense, I think you've told me before, you had a sense that the franchise might move on and look for a new general manager at that point. I'm guessing that doesn't impact your job, though. You're still approaching a trading deadline. You're still looking to make the club as good as possible. But what was kind of, you know, what was kind of the atmosphere at that point? Did you have a sense?
Yeah, well, I was ready to transition out of the position as GM, and I had notified Mark Attanasio on that. I had done the job for 20 years. I was 63 years old at the time. And just looking that it was time, I just felt it was time to give Mark an opportunity to have someone else. He inherited me, and I'm very grateful that being inherited by an owner, that he kept me around for as long as he did, 12, 13, 15 years, I forget what it was now, 04 to, well, I'm still an advisor, so he still has me on the roster. So, but I'm very grateful to that, and I told him that. I said, you know, when I was in Texas, new owners came in, Tom Hicks, and we went to the playoffs 3 out of 4 years, and they signed Alex Rodriguez, had a bad year, and I was let go the following year. And that's so Hicks wanted to bring his own person in. He had inherited me. So that doesn't happen very often where an owner inherits a general manager and you get that kind of length of career that I was able to get with the Brewers. But I just thought it was time. Craig was in the manager's seat at that time. And I just thought it was time for, you sort of get a gut feeling for it that I think it would, I think I just wanted to tell Mark that it was time for him to go out and try to find someone. And, you know, the game was changing a little bit from a little bit old school to the analytical world and that. And, you know, I think those changes were starting to happen in baseball back in 2015, then 16, and now it's taken off now. And it was just the part of my career that I do enjoy. I think there was analytics in my career, but not to the extent that it is today.
Sure. So I got to know what you thought, because speaking of inheritance, you know, the Brewers are still reaping the benefits of this last deal, essentially, that you made before transitioning to something else. You know, not only that, you, of course, hired Craig Counsell to be manager, which was kind of seen as an outside-the-box move, and he's the longest-tenured manager in the National League. But I'd be curious where this ranks for you personally, this last deal, which I guess, ironically, coincidentally, might be one of your best. It certainly has helped the Milwaukee Brewers. How do you think about it? There's all these sliding doors that go with it too. You of course have Mike Fiers getting caught up in the Houston Astros cheating scandal. You've got the Mets getting a lot out of Wilmer Flores at a walk-off home run. Then they trade for Yoenis Cespedes, who helps them get to the World Series that year. I mean, that's got to be a little amusing, you know, seeing all the way that things shook out. How when you look at this trade, what sticks out for you?
Well, I think in looking at the trade and when I transitioned out of the general manager's position, you know, my goal when you do that, you always want to leave the club. You don't want to leave it bare and not have talent. And I think that I think that's the thing that I'm most proud of is that, you know, Bruce Seid, our scouting director that passed away,
yeah,
Bruce would be so proud of, you know, Tyrone Taylor now on the team and Brent Suter and Brandon Woodruff and Ray Montgomery and Bruce Seid both handled our scouting at the time, amateur scouting, and some of those players, you know, are still there. Devin Williams was a draft pick of that group. And if you look at Devin Williams and Alan Hayter and Woodruff, Suter, Tyrone Taylor, I'm not sure that, you know, people thought Tyrone Taylor would be the player he was, but I can tell you Bruce Seid did. He always told me this guy's going to be a good player. He's a good athlete. Just be patient with him. And those amateur scouts, they would fight for their players a lot and that. So that's the part that when you transition out is you want to make sure you leave the club in a good position for who's coming in to make some trades, to maybe have some players come from the farm system. And, you know, and David, you know, made some good trades. You know, they had players there. There was Chris Davis, Maldonado. There was Gene Segura. There was Adam Lynn, who brought Freddie Peralta back. So there was players there to trade. I don't think the cupboard was bare. And in the transition to David and his staff, they've done a very good job in taking over at that point to have sustainable success. And that's the biggest challenge as a general manager, is to have sustainable success, you know, year after year after year, trying to contend. And that's the one thing that I look back on our clubs. I wish that we had a little more success. We had a tough division at that. Division was pretty tough back then. There were some good ball clubs at that point, but I'd like to have had a good 4, 5, 6 year run of playoff runs. It's very hard to do in the game today.
Well, Doug, I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time. Yeah, Hader and Williams, 4 straight reliever of the year awards between them. So I'd say in this regard, the goal was accomplished. The team much better off. Really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks, Doug. We'll talk to you hopefully again down the line.
Okay, Jared. Thanks very much.
Buying a car in Carvana was so easy. I was able to finance it through them.
Whoa, wait, you mean finance?
Yeah, finance. Got pre-qualified for a Carvana auto loan, entered my terms, and shopped from thousands of great car options all within my budget.
That's cool that financing through Carvana was so easy.
Financed. Done. And I get to pick up my car from their Carvana vending machine tomorrow.
Financed.
Right, that's what I said.
You can spend time trying to pronounce financing, or you can actually finance and buy your car today on
Carvana.
Financing subject to credit approval. Additional terms and conditions may apply.